Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. I guess I've been here for probably the 12th Pawarana, maybe 10th Pawarana talk I've given, and I think I've had to go first three times. So it's not, I don't know what the probability of that is, but I seem to get the first place an inordinate proportion of the time. But yeah, and this is, I was just looking around the room and seeing that, yeah, we don't announce this event, but the people who know are here. I know, yeah, it's good to see so many familiar faces. And yeah, I was just contemplating, and it was announced that my title got changed to Ajahn Kachana, and just, yeah, reflecting on taking on new roles. And I think that it sunk in a bit for me at the Buddhist bicycle pilgrimage. I think I went on, I mean, I started volunteering for the Buddhist bicycle pilgrimage, I think in 2003 as a layperson. And so then I was tagging along and serving food, serving food to bicyclists at the pit stops, and going to the KOA campground Saturday and listening to Ajahn Amaro give a talk. And then I came to Abayagiri, and did one more stint on pit crew when I was just a layperson here in 2006. And then I think as an Anagarika, I followed Ajahn Amaro, and then we slept in a cabin instead of a tent, and I was sort of looking after Ajahn Amaro as best I could, and I kept going for novice years. And in there, I haven't counted how many I've done as a monastic, but then for the past 2 years, the ride went to the Alokavihara in Placerville, so Abhayagiri monastics didn't have to cover it, and then the community volunteered to help out with it again this year, and so I volunteered to go as the senior monk, and Thanh Ngun Awiro was the junior monk, and Anagarika Jordan was driving. Yeah, just to see. And so yeah, been just to see how that change happens. And now I'm the one making the decisions, and other people are moving my sandals around. And yeah, I mean, you sort of reflect on it because it feels, definitely don't feel like Ajahn Amaro. He seemed to have a way of relating to people that was, beyond my capacity. And sort of inner strength also beyond my capacity, but I can still do. I can still help out with the Buddhist bicycle pilgrimage. And yeah, we faced some challenges. It was the first year that it rained that I can remember. But I was really impressed with the organizer, Peter Krimen, who, did just great, despite the rain. The theme was equanimity, so it was a good theme for a rainy bike ride. And, I mean, did a few modifications to the event, holding meditation inside instead of outside. And, things went quite smoothly. I think actually what most impressed me was Peter Krimen said at the end of it, just how he had hit, with the rain, he had had, and unfortunately I can't remember his exact words, but the rain is not what you plan for, not what you want. Makes the whole cycling thing quite a bit more difficult. You know, the cyclists, I saw them all spraying mud off their rims at the rock shop, for example. But he said that he had basically, he was pretty nervous about the rain, but he'd more or less just, learned how to let go, and then the whole thing ran just fine. And that was, and he sounded like, he sounded like a person who was used to planning things, and then just to watch, to learn how to let go and let the pilgrimage sort of guide it, but it sort of runs itself. And for me, that's, at least right now, that's much more of a, I don't think, unlike Ajahn Amaru, I don't think I could create a Bayagiri, not by a long shot. But sort of do my part to keep it running. So just reflecting on change and the nature of this place. I'll offer that for your reflection.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. For some reason, I was really surprised my name was picked second. This is my second Pawarna talk that I've given as a novice. It feels pretty similar to the first one. Last night was my first time leading the puja because Samana Rakuto was on retreat and the bhikkhus had a meeting. I get pretty nervous. I think most people do. But this kind of thing in particular, and like leading the retreat or the puja last night, I find it's a good opportunity to kind of just sit with the really uncomfortable feelings that come up. It's not like it's, it's expected. Like I knew before the puja that I was going to be doing that. And like tonight, I knew I'd be giving a talk, sitting in front of a mic in front of a crowd, so I knew I could anticipate it would be uncomfortable. But one thing that I heard from the speaker was that if you go into situations, difficult situations, voluntarily, then you can get more, you can benefit more from it, get more out of it, as opposed to kind of maybe going into it unconsciously, or and just not really paying attention. And before coming to the monastery, I tried to got myself up onto I guess some stages, like playing guitar and singing. I think I was okay. But it was more of a way just to kind of put myself in an uncomfortable situation. So I wanted to be more comfortable in front of a crowd, and I think it maybe helped a little bit. But apparently when I was younger, I wasn't so shy. My mom told me that she has memories of us being at restaurants. And I guess I would go into the bathroom and start singing at the top of my lungs. And of course, I don't remember that today. She said people would just kind of like look at, like the waitstaff would just like look at each other or just laugh. But yeah, not much more self-conscious today, which maybe isn't such a bad thing. There's a lot, probably more I could say, but I don't know if I need to really say any more. Keep it short and sweet.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Well, before this puja started, I was telling other members of the community that I was not nervous. And I wasn't, but the body kind of does what it wants. I was inclined to decline from giving a talk this evening, but I was strongly encouraged by my seniors to speak, so here I am. In the Dhamma seat. I presume that most of you are here for spiritual guidance. And although that I'm the most junior member of the community, both by ordination and by age, I'll try to say something helpful in the next 5 to 10 minutes. I was thinking a bit about what to talk about, and well, I thought I could try to help them reach Nibbana, but I haven't done that myself yet, so it would be rather difficult. There are other things that I couldn't explain either because I've never really had to struggle with them. For example, I'm not bragging, I'm just saying this as a truth. The fifth precept, for example, has breaking that has never really been a temptation for me, so I don't really know what it's like to overcome that specific challenge, although there are universal characteristics of craving and defilement. I guess one success that I've had that I can maybe try to expand on is, as some folks are aware, I don't eat sugar or sweets, or dessert or things like that, and that has not always been the case. Growing up, I was a normal kid. I guess Halloween is around the corner here. I used to love that holiday and all the candy it entailed. But somewhere along the line, I decided that that indulgence was detrimental. And I'm not here to convince anyone to stop eating sweets or sugar, just to speak about my own experience. I guess one thing I can say is that every time I would indulge, well, there was dukkha. Something like a piece of cake or candy, it's such a quick experience, fleeting. It doesn't last, and because of that, it's unsatisfying. And so either you try to content yourself with a small amount of dessert, or you end up really binging and feeling pretty terrible afterwards. At least those seemed like the options to me. So I got kind of sick of those options and decided to try to find a way out, namely renouncing dessert. One thing that I noticed was that the craving wasn't really, say, when I, quote, decided to eat a sweet or a dessert, it wasn't really an active decision-making process. It was more like a craving would arise, and I would sort of go along with it, like, oh, that sounds pretty good. Right. So it really felt more like giving in to some kind of idea that wasn't my own. It's kind of like a surrender or capitulation, or that's what it felt like anyway. Like I was giving in, like I wasn't in control. And I think maybe part of that desire to be in control of those choices was part of what helped me. So that's one thing that can be helpful. Another thing is, and I'm trying to generalize this experience, so try to see the craving as not your own, and it's something that you have to give your assent to. You don't have to, but in order for you to indulge in something, there's an active process of giving in. So there's the opportunity to say no, however difficult it may be. A second thing that can be helpful is to tally or take stock of sort of the detrimental effects of whatever the behavior or the action is. again, I'm not here to try to convince anybody that sugar is bad. But I thought it was for various reasons. So that helped as well, just reminding myself, okay, if I... if I go through with this, if I eat this dessert, or so on and so forth, what are the possible negative effects of it? And recounting those helped me to abstain. Another piece of advice that some other members of the community here have given me, not about this, but it applies generally, is to ask oneself, sort of, how did this, last time I did this, how did it make me feel? And do I really want to feel that way again? So that can be helpful. And so I think those three things, but those are three tools that I can offer for dealing with craving in a sort of practical way. And one thing I can say is it's been several years now since I sort of renounced sweets and desserts, and I can say that at this point the craving is pretty much in remission. I mean, I don't really experience it at all. So I don't know if it's going to come back, but I feel pretty victorious at this point. So just to give people hope that if you're really struggling with some sort of behavior that you think is unhealthy, that it gets easier. And there are things that you can do to overcome those difficulties. Oh, I hope that was helpful.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Bhutang tamang sanghang namasami.
I'm just returning tonight from a week with my dad, who's 91, about to be 92. And it's, yes, kind of landing, just landing again back at the monastery. Trying to let the thoughts kind of flow and just see what comes up. A couple things have come up. This 2018 has brought a lot of change for all of us. It started with a loss of my brother in February, and I didn't even realize how much that affected me for quite some time, because I was so busy helping my sister-in-law deal with all the things that a person has to do when their partner or whoever dies. And then we had a pro bono attorney who had to leave, and she's been a part of the support for this monastery from the very beginning. and just has always offered her services, and just a very eccentric, lovely, incredibly sharp person. And for reasons of her physical and mental health, she had to leave her home of 40-something years in the Anderson Valley, and that was a very difficult thing for her. And we went to see her off. And then the next day was Beth's last day. And the dam, everything kind of hit the fan, and the dam broke, and a lot of emotion. A lot of emotion, and there was no stemming it. It was just coming. And it lasted, the reverberations physically lasted for days. I went down to my dad's at that time. And really just the physical awareness of this kind of energy in the body was really apparent for at least, 4 or 5 days. And kind of what I notice more now is, actually, when Lopore left, we had to say goodbye to him, but it actually didn't affect me so bad. I found that actually easier, and it seems like that release of that, without knowing it, kind of holding this grief or whatever you want to call it, gave space for mudita to arise. So what I really felt for Lopore was a tremendous amount of mudita, that he was, after all these years and after all that he's done for so many different communities, but for this one in particular, he was going to get time to just be in retreat and put his efforts more into the formal side of practice. And I noticed that also perhaps as a result of that release, things are much closer to the surface. So things affect me much more readily as far as, just more openness to the flow of the feelings. And for example, my father just recently got in a situation where they took his license away, and to qualify to get his license back is a series of tests and meetings with neurologists, and he does have some, he's almost 92. His memory card is full, so he does have some short-term memory issues, and he kind of took my brother somewhere that he doesn't normally drive, and then he got on the freeway, and he hasn't driven on the freeway in a long time. And so he was, a trip that should have taken a half an hour took him 3 hours. And the police actually, the last hour, they were out looking for him, and they escorted him home. But he was going to probably have to do all these tests anyway, because his license was coming up in February. But it's, being with him, one of the most important things in his day is going to church. And so he doesn't have the ability to do that on his own. And I was just with him, so I was spending a lot of time. And I feel in myself, I feel a certain sadness because I understand he feels a sense of loss. So I'm coming back to that feeling of emotion, just my being more aware of how that affects me, because I care about him and I want to support him in whatever way I can. And I think that being more open to that flow has enabled me actually to be more open in considering what it's like for him considering that he doesn't necessarily remember everything we tell him. And so just is given a lot more space, allowing for a lot more patience. And more compassion. And I think the thing that's so striking is that we just, we don't realize sometimes how we're holding things. So I feel really grateful for the opportunity to really see and feel and experience that deeply embedded kind of sorrow, whatever, grief. And to know in the release of that, that not only can we become more spacious and it allows more awareness of the other emotions that come up, or the other, like metta, like compassion, more understanding of the situation or how it might be for someone else. And I think it also allows a little bit more creativity and openness in how to address certain situations. How to be with certain situations, even the uncomfortable ones. And so I guess, maybe because that's been more at the surface. I've found this Vasa has been a challenge because the changes and I lost a Dhamma sister. She went the other side of the planet, I didn't realize that was going to feel like such a loss, and it really. I really notice her absence, I'll put it that way. I notice it profoundly in many ways. And I have a wonderful office mate who's very helpful and very warm and very caring. And that's really helpful. All the people that come, the support of the community is really helpful. But I also have to acknowledge that just been in kind of an altered state for a lot of the Vasa. And what I feel like is the support of this community and the stability of this community, the stability of just the form kind of keeps being passed on. And so people leave and more people, like they go somewhere else or whatever, and more people come in, and there's this regularity, and that's been very helpful. And just patience. And I think that's one of the biggest ones, and just being open to what has been going on and what it feels like. So just a lot of gratitude for the practice, the space to actually be with what is, and the encouragement to be open and honest is probably what's coming up for me tonight.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So there's a quote that I remember hearing about Ajahn Chah, something about something along the lines of practicing at the shores of death. some reason, at times of feeling anxiety, I've always or often found that quote reassuring somehow. So, 10th Vasa, good time to reflect. Gone through various ups and downs over the 10 years, and certainly hasn't felt like a easy ride all the way, but very glad and appreciative to have hung in there all this time, and appreciative of all the support directly and indirectly. Ajahn Jayasaro made the reference that referring that this is sort of, there is culture or tradition. One of the things I'm looking back grateful for over the years of that we have this culture, this Buddhist practice culture. For example, out in sort of popular culture, regular world, you have to be very careful about talking about people's age or reminding people of their mortality. But here in the monastery, you might even be doing somebody a favor if you remind them they're going to die. So I appreciate the various sort of ways that in this culture that we sort of are willing to accept and open up to these various some of the harsher realities. Also, that it's what we do by body, speech, and mind that really is most important. It's not, it's easy in a sense to blame the president or other people out there or other people far away or other people nearby or wherever for what's wrong. But, you know, here we're just, what matters most is what we, our intentional action by body, speech, or mind, and that sense of being willing to take responsibility. Appreciate that. I also appreciate us the way and that we generally accept this. In this tradition, it's, you know, generally said that, you know, if one is reborn, if one takes a human birth, then that means that one has a certain level, means one has a defilement, and that we acknowledge that all or the vast majority of us have some greed, anger, or delusion. And that's a hard, we don't like to think about these things, but appreciate that we're willing to acknowledge that we have these things and that that's where our work lies. And then I guess just as being part of this culture, this tradition, something, think about what do I really appreciate, what do I really value? You know, it's not not particularly pleasant on the sort of material realm, but there's this sense if we're when we're practicing sincerely, even though we certainly, well, even though we likely don't win, you know, we can't overcome all our greed or anger or delusion. If we're trying, if we're practicing the way, then if we're sincerely practicing, then at least we have a, our life has a, we're engaged in sort of a meaningful quest, a meaningful mission. And just that, that right there, there's a sense of well-being. So I offer this for consideration.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So just to kind of echo some of the sentiments brought up by Samaner Chittipalo, so it's kind of interesting stuff that comes up in a situation like this. Give my first Dhamma talk. Of course, it's supposed to be unrehearsed. So, you know, it's just interesting to see the kinds of mental states that come up. Uncertainty, self-doubt, anxiety, fear, or, you know, even the thrill of the unknown, amongst other mental qualities. I feel like it's really good that, you know, in the monastery where we get a chance to see this stuff come up. I feel that that's kind of been one of the characteristic features of my time as an Anagarika, or even just being in the monastery in general as a long-term guest. I remember you know, when I first came here, it really wasn't what I expected it to be. And it didn't take long before, you know, just following the daily routine, I began to become sensitive to just an overwhelming sense of bleakness that I was experiencing on a day-to-day basis. Seemed like every single day, you know, my mind was just a gray, swirling soup of uncomfortable emotions. Just, you know, of course, on the coarse level, sensual passion, irritation with people who might annoy you. Anxiety about kind of living in the wilderness was a big one for me. Constantly thinking every noise I heard was a mountain lion or a bear. rattlesnakes, black widows, Lyme disease. Constantly imagining the worst case scenario. Fear, self-doubt, self-consciousness, insecurity, confusion, questioning, am I doing enough? Things of this nature. At one point, I made it a practice to just start doing loving-kindness meditation every night before going to sleep. Just a half hour of that. And I found that that actually had some pretty notable effects for me. One thing I noticed right away was that it started changing the tone of my dreams. And one thing that was really nice about that was that I slept easier. And that meant that I woke up easier. And that meant that my day was easier because I was well rested. And then I would have that much more energy to reinforce the cycle. So just kind of working with this practice for a while, I did feel my experience just kind of brightening up a bit. And then I remember one time after several months of being here, just kind of looking back to kind of those bleak emotions I was feeling, and just realizing that it wasn't like that anymore. And there was a real sense that, I've gained that much happiness. I've lost that much suffering. And there's a sense that it's long-lasting. There's a sense that there was some internal work that was happening there, and it's not a short-lived thing. I think that's just because that stuff was always kind of there under the surface, but it just didn't have really a chance to come out. And I think that's the beauty of being able to be in an environment like this, is that you get to see all that stuff. And that itself is just a real blessing. Being able to become sensitive to what's going on beneath the surface. There were a couple metaphors that came to my mind just, doing various activities around the monastery. Remember when I was a long-term guest, we had a deck staining project, and part of this involved cleaning some posts that kind of become saturated with mold over time. And so we had to basically spray on a bunch of OxyClean to get the mold to kind of come out so that it could be wiped away. The thought occurred to me, this is just like being in a monastery. The post is like the mind, the mold is like the defilements, and then the OxyClean is like living on the eight precepts. Kind of saturate the post with the OxyClean, and over time that kind of reveals the mold that's, kind of ingrained within it. In the same way, just, embracing the renunciant lifestyle, even in its most rudimentary form, by living on the eight precepts, really gives, just allowing the mind to soak in that really allows certain kind of defilements to come up. And that gives one the opportunity to, address them appropriately. Whereas before, they would just kind of lie dormant. remember the night after I became an Anagarika, it rained. And I remember just walking down the hill that morning for morning puja. And, you know, of course, I was trying to keep my clothes as white as I could. When I came down to the cloister, I just kind of did a scan of my cloth requisites, see if, you know, I was in tip-top shape. I wasn't. I looked back, much to my dismay. My pants were just covered in mud. And the thought occurred to me, you know, being in a monastery is like wearing white clothes for the first time. You know, it's like, you know, when you're out in the world, you know, you're wearing your regular clothes, you know, they're constantly getting dirty, but you just don't see it because, you know, your clothes have this certain color to them, so it just blends right in. But then when you're wearing white clothes, you know, you see the dirt that was always accumulating there. It just stands out. That's what being in a monastery is like. And again, it's just, you know, it's not a great thing to, you know, have to accept. Of course, it'd be better if, you know, your clothes were just clean all the time, but truth is they're not, and it's good to confront that truth. It's good to confront the truth that, you know, the mind has its hindrances. It's got its obstacles. It's got its weaknesses, its faults. And we have the chance to address that here, which is really a great blessing. Leave it there.